Budget week brings boldness. Reform is back in fashion. Labor winding back tax breaks for investors. The Coalition wants to make bracket creep a thing of the past. The Treasurer joins us this morning. I'm David Spears. Welcome to Insiders. The rising tide of global populism has achieved at least one thing. The major parties have sprung into action. In its fifth budget, and boldest so far, the Albanese government has gone after negative gearing, capital gains tax and trusts. In his first budget reply, Angus Taylor has gone for broke. He's promised to end bracket creep by indexing tax thresholds, deny permanent residents access to welfare payments and slash migration. If Anthony Albanese's Achilles heel is a broken promise, for Angus Taylor, it's the lack of detail on how he'll do it all. But one thing's clear from both sides, the time for tinkering is over.
Speaker, this is the most important and ambitious budget in decades.
13 million workers to get $250 back at tax time from 2028 and every year thereafter.
We do support this measure.
The Treasurer has announced major changes to negative gearing, trusts and the capital gains tax discount.
Most of which the Prime Minister ruled out on dozens of occasions leading up to last year's election.
But you are going to face a lot of questions about breaking promises.
Now that the lie has been confirmed, will you apologise to the Australian public?
Does change translate to lie in government language?
We've come to a different view on these policy areas. We're explaining to the Australian people why.
We've been throwing everything at housing supply, but it hasn't been enough.
Bill Shorten did take it to an election and lost twice.
How sweet is that vindication, Bill?
A good idea has arrived. It took a little bit longer than I'd have hoped.
The Treasurer promises the changes will make it easier for first home buyers to compete with investors.
There are a lot of Gen Z voters thinking about, well, what if I want to negatively gear sometime in the future?
We absolutely don't support the assault on aspiration in this budget.
I see this as nothing but communism taking over and redistributing wealth.
The government wants to pass these changes pretty soon. Will you help them get this done?
Well, we're going to wait and see the legislation first.
That brings the amount of money that we have invested in this critical thing for the country up to $6.3 billion. This is going to build many more homes for our country, and it's essential that we get on with it.
From Farage to Farah, the choice this moment presents for parties of government is really clear. We are the last ones standing in the sensible centre of Australian politics.
They've delivered a shit sandwich and we've now got to eat it.
Angus Taylor has handed down his bold federal budget reply.
A coalition will cap immigration numbers based on the number of homes constructed each year.
Tax brackets would be linked to inflation.
Set to save workers up to $1,000 a year.
This is generational tax reform.
Yeah.
It's fair, it's simple and it's honest.
Just give me a number for how much indexing tax will cost the budget bottom line.
Well, it'll be what is necessary to alleviate those numbers that I just described.
Angus Taylor,
Sarah,
how do you restore your economic credentials if you won't put a number
Sarah,
on
the number,
new policy that you're presenting?
The number will depend on the inflation rates we see close to the election.
Over the forward, it's about $22.5 billion, and that has been fully costed and offset.
Angus Taylor wants to fight One Nation. We want, as the Labor government, to fight for our nation.
Well, it's been a big budget week. Let's bring in our panel, Phil Khoury, the political editor of the Australian Financial Review. Alan Kohler, great to have you on the Insiders couch for the first time, the ABC's finance presenter and the host of the excellent That's Business podcast. Samantha Maiden, political editor of news.com.au. Phil, let me start with you. We clearly have a stark difference between the two sides on tax now. How do you think the two sides are looking at the end of this budget week? What are they really trying to achieve with what they've put forward?
Well, I think it's probably too early to tell how everyone's looking. I mean, the government's clearly got a problem on the integrity front if you separate, you know, the merit or otherwise of the measures they announced, and they're clearly aware of that. And but I think what we've got, Dave, is just like this ideological separation now. We've had on the economy and on tax, we've got the clearest delineation, I think, for a long time. Between, we've got, you know, this is the real Labor, the sort of redistribute the wealth in the name of fairness, and then you've got, you know, the Conservative saying the best way to help people is through, you know, aspiration and investment and stuff, and not taking off people. So you've got two parties claiming to be able to do the same thing through different methods, and it's, you know, we haven't sort of seen this this clear split for such a long time.
Alan, how do you think these two offerings stack up for Labor, the move on negative gearing and capital gains tax and trusts, and for Angus Taylor, indexing tax thresholds?
Well, they're both going back to the past in a way. I mean, the CGT discount was introduced in 1999 to replace the inflation adjustment to capital gains. And I think it's pretty clear now that that was a mistake. It was done as a result of a business tax review that was prepared by three businessmen who had 10 board seats between them. And they were talking their book, basically. When they recommended the discount in their review, they said it was to enliven and invigorate the Australian equity market, that is the share market. They didn't mention real estate at all. So it was, and that was what it was about. And they wanted to get the share prices of their own companies up and also their own shareholdings, personally. And 9 months after that recommendation, the stock market crashed as a result of the internet bubble bursting. And so nobody wanted to enliven or invigorate the share market anymore.
It all went into property.
And it all went into property as a result. And so it was just, I think, simply a mistake that was done. And so now all we're doing is going back to what it was.
And on the other side, indexing tax thresholds. What do you think of this idea to end bracket creep forever?
Well, Malcolm Fraser did that in 1976. And it is this, it's the sort of thing you can only do from opposition in a campaign, right? So Fraser campaigned on it in the 75 election. He won it. He was going to win it anyway, so he probably didn't need to do it. And then he introduced it in 76 and withdrew it six years later, saying that nobody thanked him for it.
You don't get to hand out a tax cut every few years.
The thing about bracket creep is, and Angus Taylor's right and Malcolm Fraser was right, that it's a secret tax increase. But that's the kind of tax increase you want as a politician. You want them to be secret, right?
And he'll pay for stuff.
And so what happens when you do indexation that Angus Taylor's now doing is you end up with secret tax cuts, which is the opposite of
good politics. You're not getting any credit for it. Yeah.
So you're going from secret...
Sam... when you look at, you know, how the two sides have finished this budget week, and they're going to both be on the hard sell, no doubt about it, this is more reform than we've seen in recent years.
Yeah.
Is caution now out the window?
Look, I think what it is this comes down to what you think is the purpose and the mission of a Labor government, right? Now, I'm not convinced that the changes will make a massive dent to housing. They say it's about 75,000 people will enter the housing market that might...
Over a decade.
So it's 7,500 per year, right? Now, don't get me wrong, I think that they think that that is important and that that will make some contribution, but I think that the overarching story of this budget is that they have looked at the tax system and said we have too many people on high incomes with accountants being able to get out of paying tax legally, and we have too many people who are wage earners who are paying more tax by comparison to people that are earning more. So this is high risk. I think there is an element of mutual assured destruction here, which I think is a bit interesting in that not only Jim Chalmers but Anthony Albanese completely owns these changes. And so I think that that is something, you know, we may have time to talk about later that has got to play out. But I think basically it comes down to what is the purpose of being a government, a Labor government, if you're not going to do anything?
Yeah. Now, there are some polls out this morning in the News Corp papers, and worth, you know, prefacing this with usually the immediate post-budget polls are never, you know, particularly glowing of what the budget's just produced. These ones show that more people think they're going to be worse off than better off. More people think the economy is going to be worse off than better off. And Sam, separately, you've got a bit of polling as well on this trust issue after the broken promise.
Yeah, so this was some polling that was commissioned by Amplify, and it basically suggests that a majority of voters are now less likely to trust the Albanese government. That has potential flow-on effects, I think, at the next election, which is going to be really interesting. Now, the Prime Minister tells us he's going to run at the next election, but as we found out on budget night, things can change.
What are you suggesting?
Well, I just wonder how this plays out. Like, it's either going to work or it's not going to work, right? And the early indications are the Labor Party is... alert but not alarmed. I mean, their focus group stuff isn't too bad. Some of the property investors don't like it when they're told at their grandfather that they're okay. So the Labor Party isn't panicking about this, but it's very early days and the impact of these sort of budget is going to be a slow burn. We're not going to know how this affects the standing for some time.
What? Yeah, I agree. I think people are still trying to work out what it means for them. I think the thing that's been not talked about as much is the impact on trust. So many people had trusts. Now, a lot of people would have voted for Labor at the last election thinking, you know, their trust was fine. They had no idea this was coming. There's a dark sense of betrayal out there for what's happened. I mean, we talk about, you know, what's next. I mean, if you look at what's happened to the discretionary testamentary trusts, they're trusts that people... If you and your partner, you put your asset, when you draw up your will, if you both die in a car accident or something like that and your kids are young, those assets go into one of them. They're not an income-splitting trust. They're there for, you know, if the kids aren't old enough to handle the inheritance. And now that gets hit with the 30%. So that's being labelled a death tax, by stealth. You know, some kid who's 5 years old might be paying 30% on their income from a trust if their parents die. These sorts of things, these sorts of details are now starting to come out. So I think it's going to take a while for people to work out what it means.
I think it's probably worth bearing in mind that the money from these changes, CGT and negative gearing, don't start until 28, 29 in the budget. It's $1.35 million in that first year and then $2.7 million in the following year, which is after the next election. So really, what they've done is announced something that they are taking to the next election and the money doesn't start actually... People don't have to start paying it until after the next election.
Yeah. Well, it does start before then, but you're right, the big pickup is beyond 28. Well, time to talk to Treasurer Jim Chalmers. First, he was the opposition leader on Sky News this morning on the suggestion that his plan to index the tax thresholds might cost the budget as much as $250 billion over a decade.
If Labor's saying that they plan to raise income taxes to the tune of $250 billion in the next 10 years, that is their tax hike. That's their planned income tax increases. Now, if Labor wants to crow about their planned income tax increases of $200 billion, that's all going to be coming away from the private sector. That is a plan to grow government and shrink the private sector forever. Forever.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, David.
Let's start with this idea from Angus Taylor about indexing tax thresholds. Why won't you end bracket creep once and for all?
Well, we are cutting income taxes. We're cutting income taxes five times using three different mechanisms. And the last time we cut income taxes, Angus Taylor voted against it and said that he would repeal it. So we are cutting taxes. Now, the big difference in the last week, David, I hear the panel on the couch talking about the differences that have been established. Our budget on Tuesday night was one of the most responsible in memory. And the budget reply was one of the least responsible. And one of the reasons for that is because Angus Taylor would be adding $250 billion to national debt. That would cost tens of billions of dollars in extra debt interest because he's got these uncosted, unfunded tax announcements that he made in his budget reply, which is all about trying to stave off One Nation. And so that's the big difference here. We're cutting taxes in a responsible way. He's got an irresponsible way to go about it. He would dramatically increase debt. There would be much bigger deficits. There would be more inflation as well, remembering that what Angus Taylor is really saying is that he would pump the most amount of money into the economy when inflation is at its highest. So there are a number of problems with what Angus Taylor is proposing, but overwhelmingly, this extra $250 billion in debt and tens of billions of dollars in extra debt interest makes his budget reply, I think, the least responsible that I've seen.
Well, if it's $250 billion over the decade, that's a lot of bracket creep that you're going to be relying on in the budget. Is that right? You need to... The budget is propped up by this $250 billion of bracket creep.
Well, what we have shown, David, and not just said, is that this government is enthusiastically returning bracket creep, and on more than one occasion, our opponents have tried to prevent us from doing that. So five different tax cuts.
But why can't you lock it in and just say we're going to permanently end bracket creep and index the tax thresholds? Is it because you want the political benefit of being able to hand out, what is it, five tax cuts?
No, David, it's because when you provide these tax cuts, you have to do it in the most responsible and affordable way, and you have to take into consideration the economic conditions at the time. What Angus Taylor is proposing to do is to pump the most money into the economy when inflation is already at its highest. We've heard him say countless times that the big issue in the budget is the amount of debt. He'd be adding $250 billion in debt to the budget over the next 10 years, and that would cost the Australian people tens of billions of dollars in debt interest.
Right. So just so I'm clear, you need to keep that bracket creep in there to a degree to deal with the inflation problem. You need to be taking
that bracket creep money from the
economy.
No, David, I'm saying we return bracket creep and we've created more room to do so. Well, I don't know about that, David. I mean, for the five different tax cuts that we've put in place in three different ways, it means about $2,800 a year for the average worker. And that's because this is a government that returns bracket creep when it is responsible to do that. I've explained the issues that I think are at the very core of what Angus Taylor said on Thursday night. There's a big difference here. We cut taxes in a responsible way. He announces tax policies in an irresponsible, uncosted, unfunded way, and it would cost the Australian people dearly in debt interest.
All right, but if you're seriously saying you're going to return all bracket creep, you would be returning the $250 billion that you're talking about here.
Well, we would be returning bracket creep, as we have been, in the most responsible way we can. We said in the budget, papers and subsequently, including at the National Press Club and countless other interviews that I've done since the budget, that what we've done here by managing the budget in the most responsible way is we have created room to return more bracket creep into the future. It's important that that's done in a responsible and in an affordable way. What Angus Taylor is proposing is neither responsible nor affordable.
How much extra tax will your changes to negative gearing, capital gains tax and trusts actually raise? How much will it collect over the decade?
Well, I'll come to the decade in a minute, David, but over the course of the forward estimates, our tax reform package is broadly neutral. We are returning what we're raising to workers and businesses, principally small businesses. Now, over the 10-year period, the capital gains and negative gearing changes are a little bit over $40 billion. And the trust changes are also a little bit over $40 billion. But there's also the tax cuts in there, the Working Australian Tax Offset over the course of the next 10 years. There's loss carryback tax cuts for business. So overall, we've pointed out, David, that if you look at that 10-year period, there's about three times as much savings as there is tax changes in net terms. But those two specific categories are a little bit over $40 billion each.
So just around over $80 billion. The reporting all week has been that it's more than $100 billion. You're saying over the decade, the negative year in capital gains tax trust changes will actually be just over $80 billion.
Yeah, both of them are a bit over $40 billion. But as I said, David, they're not the only two elements of our tax package. There's tax cuts in the budget for business and for workers.
Look, you've argued what you're doing with negative gearing and capital gains tax in particular is about rebalancing the property market to help owners get into the market. But most of the capital gains tax collected at the moment is not from the property market. It's from, I guess, shares, unlisted investments and so on. Why are you also changing the capital gains tax rules for non-property investments?
Because we're taking one of the big distortions out of the market. I think, as Alan Kohler said on your couch a moment ago, a really big mistake was made in 1999, and it introduced this massive distortion in the way that Australians invest in our economy. It made fixed housing much more attractive, and it made other kinds of investment less attractive. So by taking that distortion out of the system, it is a fairer, more neutral treatment of investment, capital gains in particular. And if you look at the average over a couple of decades since that policy mistake was made by Howard and Costello, what you can see on average is that housing was established housing was overcompensated, shares were undercompensated. That's one of the reasons why we had this big spike in house prices. It's one of the reasons why so many people, particularly young people, have been locked out of the housing market. But it's also been why shares over time have become relatively less attractive. And so by removing
that... why then do you need to change it for shares if they've become less attractive? What's the problem you're trying to fix there?
We're trying to remove the distortion, David, by applying a fairer and more neutral treatment to capital gains. And as Alan said a moment ago, as I've been saying through the course of the week, after that mistake was made in 1999, too many people were locked out of the housing market. Obviously, the capital gain that you pay will be subject to your marginal rates, the type of investments that you've made. But over that 20-year period on average, what we saw was this massive overcompensation of people investing in established housing. And that's one of the things that has locked too many people, particularly young people, out of the housing market for too long. And that's why we're addressing it.
So what do you say then to those young people who have been, you know, trying to put aside what they can, maybe raising 10 grand, 20 grand, putting it in the share market as they try to build up their first home deposit? Now it's going to be less attractive for them to do that.
Well, not on the basis of those 20 years of experience, David. You know, we feel that the when you look at the average in that 20-year period, shares have been undercompensated. And so some people will continue to do that. It depends, obviously, on their marginal rate and the sorts of shares that they're investing in. But removing this distortion will help people make decisions based on economic outcomes rather than tax outcomes. And so some people are doing that in order to save a deposit. And also, you know, we read a lot and hear a lot about rent vesting as well, David. And that's a part of our market, but a very small part of our market. And for people
how small are investing... Because it's a good point to raise, because this idea that you know, young buyers are going for a negatively geared property as they and renting while they try to save up that deposit.
Well, first of all, they can continue to do that for the homes that they already own or the home that they already own. And they can continue to do that in the future if they invest in a new build, which is a very positive contribution that they would be making to our communities and to our economy as well. But in terms of numbers, it's much less than 5% of people under 35. The closest we get to an accurate number here is about 5% of people under 35 have got rental income, but that includes owner-occupiers, it includes people who are positively and negatively geared. So well under 5% of people under 35 are doing this. They can continue to do this if they invest in a new build, and they can continue to do it if they already own that home before budget night.
OK, so well below 5%, but there'd be more who have a bit of money in shares or an unlisted investment. You're saying to them they won't be any worse off under the capital gains tax changes?
Well, first of all, I think about 9 in 10 people under 35 don't have any shares. And for people who do, by getting rid of this distortion, which overcompensates established housing and undercompensates shares or investments in new supply of units and the like, then that would be a much fairer, much more neutral treatment of capital gains in the system. Now, we have to remember, David, as we get into the... Obviously, getting into the weeds of this is important, but we have to remember the big issue here is that the intersection of the housing market and the tax system is not working. It's locking too many people out of home ownership. And so our primary motivation here is to better align the tax treatment of people who work and people who earn their income in other legitimate ways. But the real goal here is to try and fix a quarter of a century where people have found it too hard to get a toehold in the market, particularly younger people. Now, of course, some people will pretend that the current arrangements in the housing market and the tax system are working just fine. We don't agree. We think the status quo is broken, and that's why we're fixing it.
What about for startups? Are you going to have to change the rules here for investing in startups?
We do recognise that startups and venture capital, and particularly the tech sector, have got a different kind of cost-based calculation. We actually were engaging with the sector before budget night because we recognise that. You can see in the budget papers that we mentioned this specifically. The Treasury has already had a couple of formal consultations with the Tech Council and I think the Investment Council as well. I've had a number of informal engagements even before budget night. So we recognise there's a different case here and we will work through the sector. It's not unusual after a big tax change is announced for there to be consultation on implementation, and we flagged for some time that we are prepared to do that, and that's already begun.
On the initial reaction to the budget, you would have seen the polls this morning. More people think they're going to be worse off than better off. More people think the economy will be worse off. People don't seem to be thrilled with the budget at this point. If this was your most ambitious budget, Treasurer, are you disappointed with that initial reaction?
No, I'd be more surprised if there was a bounce, frankly. We didn't do this to get a bounce in the polls. We did it to get a boost in first home ownership, particularly among younger Australians who've been locked out. And so if you think about it, you know, we've got this budget is full of hard decisions, not handouts. We've got a global oil shock putting a lot of pressure on people. We've got the usual predictable scare campaign based on lies from people who've got a commercial or a partisan interest here. So we didn't do it to help our primary vote. We did it to help more people realise the aspiration of home ownership, and that matters more to us than any opinion poll published a few days after the budget.
What about broken trust, though? Will the fact there's a broken promise here make it harder for voters to believe you in the future?
Look, I think some people will focus on that. You know, I understand that. I've acknowledged that the government did come to a different view, but I think some people... Hopefully a lot of people will focus on the substance of what we are trying to do here. And it would have been the easiest thing in the world, David, to make a political decision to leave everything just as it is. But the longer that we left that, the harder this problem would have become for a lot of people.
Well, in fairness, it would have been more difficult to take this to an election, wouldn't it?
Well, what we took to the election reflected our position at the time, which is that supply is the main game. We still think that. Building more homes, as the budget will do.
And you weren't thinking about capital gains tax at all?
No, we thought that the policies that we had overwhelmingly on supply, as well as the 5% deposits policy, which has been really successful too, we thought that that would be sufficient. And those things around supply, our efforts on supply are still the main thing that we are doing. But they can't be the only thing while so many young Australians are locked out of the market. And so I do understand, David, I acknowledge to all of your viewers and to the country beyond that when a government changes its position, as we have, on some big and controversial policies, that some people will focus on that part of it, some people will focus on the politics, but I encourage people to focus on the substance of what we are trying to do here. I think for a really long time, I think for a really long time, David, people have been tired of governments taking decisions overwhelmingly for political reasons rather than for the right reasons, economic reasons. So we've taken these difficult decisions. Of course, that will be reflected in the polls. It was a budget full of hard decisions and not handouts. Some very difficult things taken on.
Sure.
And that's because helping people into the market is more important to us than boosting our primary
vote. Integrity matters when governments rule things out at an election so clearly and then do them. That matters. If you've changed your position on these things, what's next? Will you change your position on franking credits?
Well, there's no change to the treatment of franking credits in the budget, David, and I do understand once again. Well, I know that our political opponents will now engage in...
But you've set the template here, Treasurer.
Well, what we've done in the budget is we've said here's a different view to one that we had had previously and explaining why. And I genuinely think that when all of the politics washes away, the most important thing is the meaningful difference that we make to people's lives. These opinion polls after budgets are not...
I'm not asking about that. I'm just wondering whether you're going to change your position on more things. Superannuation. Will you change your position again on taxing superannuation?
Well, we've already changed the policy on superannuation. We took that to the election.
Would you go
further?
We
legislated it afterwards. Not intending to, David. We're trying to nail down the changes that we made in the budget on Tuesday night.
What about a gas tax? Would you change your position on a gas tax now?
Well, not something that we've been contemplating. Obviously, that's been there's been a lot of public debate about that. There's a lot of strong views about that, but we've made it clear that there are good reasons to prioritise our gas reservation policy and the two-way supply arrangements with our Asian refining partners, and so that's our policy.
You might change your position on that.
Well, let's talk about the policies that we have announced, David.
Well, this is the problem, isn't it? That if governments are now changing their position despite ruling things out, it leaves open all of these different changes.
Well, I understand that that's the political point that our opponents will make, David. I'd rather focus on the meaningful difference that we are making to people's lives and the budget that we handed down on Tuesday night. Yes, that involves a level of political controversy. Obviously, we expected that. But more important than taking the easy political path is to take the right decisions for the right reasons, and that's what we've done.
OK, I want to ask you about productivity. The morning after the election last year, you were on this program, you named productivity as your priority for this term. You have done some things in this budget, cutting red tape in particular, but the forecast in your budget says productivity is going to remain where it is. Do you need to do more? Is what you've done the limit, or will there be more to come on productivity?
Well, I think you're really diminishing what we did in the budget, David. What we did in the budget was to address this productivity challenge in about 15 different ways, get compliance costs down by $10 billion a year and boost GDP. So we saw some green shoots in productivity growth last year, but nowhere near enough to deliver the higher living standards that we want for our people. So we took a really substantial broad agenda of productivity and announced it on budget night. We think that will shift the needle over time. But this is a two-decade
problem.
The budget
doesn't say it's going to shift the needle. The budget says it'll remain at 1.2%.
1.2% is higher than it is now. And even though we had those good outcomes in the course of 2025, we know we've got to build on that. Now, David, we've had people talk about this productivity challenge for a couple of decades. It's not just a problem that's popped up in the last couple of years. This budget has the broadest, most comprehensive productivity package of any budget in decades, and that's because we recognise it's an issue. The more productive our economy is, the more we can lift the speed limit and grow with lower inflation, and most importantly, we can lift living standards for our people over time.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at, and finally, is this it in terms of reform and ambition for Jim Chalmers? Will you sit back now over the next 2 years of this parliamentary term, or can we expect more from you, Treasurer?
Well, I think, like any government, we're always looking to do more where we can make a meaningful difference. No one ever rules a line under a budget and says that's the whole job finished when it comes to productivity, for example, or some of these other perennial challenges in the budget. So this is a very ambitious budget because this is a very ambitious government. It was before Tuesday night. The pace of reform has picked up, I think, in ways that are welcome and important and meaningful. But reform is a direction, not a destination. And no doubt by the time we get to this time next year, we'll have the opportunity to factor in all of the developments in our economy over that 12-month period and continue to reform the economy, not as an end in itself, but so that it delivers for more people in more parts of our country. And in the case of Tuesday night's budget, to deliver for a whole generation of Australians who risk being disregarded and dismissed. And yes, that's involved a whole bunch of difficult political decisions. Yes, we will wear some political heat for that. But I'm very proud of the reforms that are in the budget because they will make a meaningful difference to the lives of a number of Australians, even if they cause us a bit of political difficulty in the near term.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers, I know it's been a big budget week. We appreciate you fronting up this morning. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Well, coming up, Superpower Summit. What does the Trump-Xi meeting mean for our region? First, let's get back to our panel. We're joined once more by Phil Currie from the Australian Financial Review, Alan Kohler from the ABC, and Samantha Maiden from news.com.au. A few interesting things in that, Phil. Perhaps we can go back to start on the bracket creep debate and why the government won't go down the path of indexing tax thresholds and Jim Chalmers putting a figure on what this is going to cost over a decade, $250 billion.
Yeah.
It's a big number, which I assume is what they'll be collecting from bracket creep. But he's saying there's a couple of problems, one being inflation. If you're handing back that much every year, that's going to stoke inflation at the wrong
time.
Well,
ostensibly, although we may be in recession by then, so the way things are going. I mean, we're talking about after the next election, so the coalition has to win first, which, you know, is a sizeable task in itself. So
yeah,
that's if you're to do it now, clearly, yeah, there'd be a problem with inflation. But look, the reason no one really wants to do it, as per what Alan was saying, is it's really expensive. It gets really expensive, and you can't, once you've sort of committed to it, you've got to roll it out.
But he'll have to offer more tax cuts.
Well, this is what they've done. This is the trick in the budget is that they haven't just sort of done this stuff on negative gearing stuff. They've set up this thing called the WATO, you know, the Working Australians Tax Offset. So at the end of the financial year, you get a cheque from the government. Now, you only get that cheque from the government if you if you pay tax on salary. So this is a way of ending tax relief for money earned on other forms of income, money in the bank, shares, assets, stuff like that. So they can just give you an extra whatta at the end of every year. And just this is what Chalmers talks about, the architecture of what they've set up. This is now, he says, now governments have an option, and you can. I would bet my bottom dollar that next year and the year after we'll be in the shadow of an election in a year's time. Yeah, perish.
That's 100% what they're going to do, and it fits into what I was saying earlier about that reshaping of the tax system. And they're clearly setting up to provide more tax cuts going forward that will be linked to PIYG.
For the election, you know, they'll double or triple the water. And this is what Taylor's done from the other side. He said you'll get 250 first up, then 500, then 7. So they're both giving you 250 increments, but through different mechanisms. The difference is Labor only goes to salary earners. The Taylor thing goes to everyone. And the danger here is you lock in these tax brackets we've already got, like sort of forever with the WOTO, when you don't move them much with the other methods.
A couple of other interesting numbers from the Treasurer on the number of young people who are rent vesting, Alan. I thought that was the first effort from the government to really push back at this campaign that's brewing on social media and elsewhere, that a lot of young people are going to feel aggrieved at losing the capital gains tax break. He's saying, well, hang on, it's a pretty small number. And when you look at the share market in particular, they've... They're not necessarily going to be worse off.
No, I don't think that there are. I don't think this is going to move the dial. There aren't that many people doing this, I don't think. I mean, I don't think it's worth. Just on the bracket creep thing, I think it's worth saying that the fundamental problem with the Australian tax system is we don't tax consumption and wealth enough. So all the weight comes on incomes. You know, like the OECD average GST is 20%. We've got 10%. So it means that the governments need bracket creep in order to pay for the growth in the government. The GST is supposed to be a growth tax and is a growth tax, but you know it isn't enough. So really they need to change the way the whole tax system works to get the weight off incomes.
Looking politically at where this budget lands, Sam, we'll see the Prime Minister all around the country this week, no doubt focusing on young homeowners or those trying to get into the market. Where are the vulnerabilities, do you think, politically for the government?
Well, I think that there are lots of vulnerabilities for the government. I think, number one, you've got to understand that the general vibe of voters right now is very pessimistic. There's a lot of aggro out there trying to tease out how much of that related to the budget would be an interesting thing. But I think the fundamental thing that's going to be tricky for the government is that it's going to be very difficult to tease out what are the actual impacts of these changes versus other things. So I'll give you the example of rent, right? Clearly, the budget papers suggest that rent might go up by 2% as a result of investors leaving the market. Lots of people say that's heroic. Whether or not it's heroic or not, the coalition, if they're effective, are going to try and make the government own every dollar of your rent increase, right? Now, how do you then prove that rents are going up? Because, for example, interest rates are going up, right? There's a lot of political dangers in there. The other thing that I thought was interesting, which I thought you were going to go to, but you didn't, was that in rent vesting, I think there's about 7,500 first home buyers that are entering the market to do that every year, very small number. He was telling us how small that was, didn't matter, nothing, it's nothing. That's the same number of people that they think will enter the housing market every year as first home buyers.
Yeah, good point. So they might shift.
No, well, into the point the I'm just trying to make is the numbers are small, right? Yeah. I mean, he's saying that rent vesting is hardly anyone. And it's the same number of people that he's going to get in through the door.
Fair point.
I mean, the young people have sort of worked this out of looking at Cheek Media and other sort of sites during the week, and there's still a fair degree of cynicism about it. I mean, the initial redistribution from this is $4.81 a week. Well, doesn't mean you're going to go from a three-bedroom to a four-bedroom house, in terms of your ambition, because you're getting $4.81 a week.
Well, they're going to have to do more.
There's a sense of underwhelming among people being underwhelmed, and, of course, a lot of them would wish these measures weren't grandfathered, which is naive. You can't not grandfather.
But they've had to break this promise because the housing accord that they signed in 2022 isn't working. They're 120,000 behind the run rate required to make the target, and so they've had to do something else. You know, and so they're skewing the tax system towards new housing.
Isn't the reality that the problem with reaching that target, getting more housing supply going, is at the state level, stamp duties, land release and approvals?
Yeah, well...
Do we need more federal pressure on the states to...
No, well, the real problem is that the housing accord's focused on approvals, getting the states to commit to a certain number, and then they give it to the councils, which is what's happened. So the councils have all got targets for approvals, but the trouble is that there's a whole lot of approvals that aren't being built because the developers can't make the projects stack up because the construction costs are too high, they haven't got enough labour. And so the government's stuck with an accord that deals with approvals, but they can't get the houses built. So now they're trying to skew it, the tax system towards it, maybe to give it a bit of a
push.
Just one issue, though, on the other side of the coalition that the Treasurer was touching on as well, is that Angus Taylor said today in an interview on Sky News that he's not going to oppose the tax cuts, but he will. He's saying he won't repeal the Watto, right? Now, this will obviously play out. There's obviously a massive element of fantasy football to this, but... The Albanese government is saying that if they don't repeal the Watto and then they're doing indexation on top, their tax changes don't cost $22 billion, they cost $35 billion over the next 4 years.
Mm. On the opposition's side, it's not just the indexing tax thresholds. Angus Taylor's also announced what he says will be one of the biggest cuts in migration in the nation's history. He can't say exactly how big the cut will be, but I think he said it will be well under 200,000 from where it is roughly now. And taking welfare payments off non-citizens, permanent residents who are non-citizens. Phil, has he made the case as to why he needs to take that latter move on taking those welfare payments away? And is that going to be dangerous for him?
Other than Pauline Hanson sitting on 27%, not
where
really.
Is that?
No. I mean, the housing argument's easier to make and more logical. It's one of the levers, you know. Tax is one lever, migration's another one, supply's another one. You can make that case.
So this is just chasing One Nation?
Oh, well, it's neutralising. I mean, Taylor said after the by-election last weekend that at best they can neutralise Hanson on what he calls the culturally sensitive issues, but where they beat Hanson and Labor potentially is on the economy. So I think we saw him trying to do both in his budget and reply speech. There was a lot of people in the Liberal Party said, OK, enough on the migration now, let's get back to where we have a clear advantage on the economy. So it'd be interesting
to see
how...
But he's doubling down on it. And the biggest cohorts of non-citizens who are permanent residents are Indian, Chinese and British. And there's a lot of them. We know the Indian Chinese communities punished the Liberals at the last two elections. Is this going to create another problem?
Well, the interesting thing about the idea of linking housing with the migration is that there's some arithmetic that suggests that that would result in reducing immigration to $130,000 people a year. I mean, that would be a massive cut to migration.
In my book on housing, I suggested that they link housing construction to immigration. But that was 2 years ago, right? And the net overseas migration in that year, 2 years ago, was 536,000 and housing completions were 175,000. So there was actually a shortfall
big gap
in that year. Mm. But now net overseas migration is down to 300,000 in the most recent year, and completions have stayed the same. So now, on that calculation, there's a surplus of housing. The housing actually... House prices have been going up because of interest rates coming down, not because of migration. In fact, if Angus Taylor tied housing to migration now, he'd have to increase migration.
Hang on, because you're saying more than one person goes into a house.
Well, the ratio is 2.4 per house, just at the moment. Even if that's come down.
And that ratio, they haven't actually said what the ratio they would use is, but if they were to use a 2.4, you're saying you'd actually have to increase migration.
Exactly.
I don't think they're going to do that. Well, that's a good point.
Well, Treasury's forecasting a reduction in migration over the next 2 years down to 225,000, which... Yep. I mean, the government should make that a target, right? It isn't a target, it's just a forecast. There is no migration target.
Just very quickly, Sam, it's not just on the migration stuff. Mm. Angus Taylor, when it comes to chasing back those who've gone to One Nation, is also now waded into the gender wars.
Yeah.
Peter Dutton was always telling his colleagues, don't go there, he wouldn't go there. Angus Taylor he's now saying that he will amend the Sex Discrimination Act to ensure that women and girls have protections based on biological sex. We'll define biological sex in the Act, male or female, the sex you are born. Dutton used to think this was pretty fringe stuff on the right.
Well, it's a very important culture issue for a lot of people in the Liberal Party, and it's obviously a big deal. This case has now gone all the way to the full federal court, and
they've been knocked back
every time, could go all the way to the High Court. So I think did you report that they were having a private members bill? No.
Yeah, the Nationals are St. Penfold's going to introduce
now
a private members bill.
So it's now an official position.
Our gender expert for Fury on this story.
All right, you're yours.
Let's move on. Some other news that we can reveal this morning. The Prime Minister is set to receive a prestigious international award later this year on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly. The Atlantic Council, it's a non-partisan global think tank, is set to bestow its Global Citizen Award on Anthony Albanese. Now, previous winners include former US Presidents George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, French President Emmanuel Macron, and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. The Atlantic Council says the award's for Anthony Albanese's inspirational leadership of Australia, his commitment to strengthening the AUKUS partnership and Indo-Pacific security cooperation, and his efforts to expand Australia's engagement across Southeast Asia and the Pacific. The PM will attend the UN General Assembly again in September. He spoke there for the first time last year and met a bunch of leaders on the sidelines. And the Atlantic Council Award will be presented at a big black tie event while he's there in New York. Phil, you were there last year as well at the UN. Anthony Albanese getting a big international gong from a think tank. Mm. How's that going to go down, do you think?
Oh, man does job. But, you know, congrats. I've not heard of this award, sorry.
Will Australians feel pride, do you think, at this, or will they...
Why not, you know? I remember when Wayne Swan got Treasurer of the Year. That's another award we'd never heard of before.
I think it could play very badly. I think it could play very badly.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't want to disparage it.
Why is that?
Because people are dirty. They're worried that there's going to be a recession. And if he's poncing about...
They don't like him getting on a plane at all.
Getting a crown on his head. I mean, I don't know.
They'll begrudge him.
It must be important if it's a black tie.
Exactly.
It's all black tie.
That's all we need to know.
Yeah. PM in a penguin suit.
Well, this is recognising his abilities on the world stage to balance the two big powers as well as build relations with middle powers. One of the hardest things for any Australian leader is balancing those great power relations between the US and China. And what have we seen over the last few days? Well, Donald Trump has been there in Beijing. He's had plenty of harsh words to say over the years about China. But if the last few days were any guide, he's been charmed in the presence of Xi Jinping.
I don't think we need any help with Iran. We have a lot of things to discuss. I wouldn't say Iran is one of them.
We hope to convince them to play a more active role in getting Iran to walk away.
Common interests between China and the United States outweigh our differences.
The military is obvious, it couldn't be better, but those children were amazing.
I look forward to exchanging views with the president on major issues concerning both countries and the world.
The relationship between China and the USA is going to be better than ever before.
President Xi Jinping pointed out that the Taiwan question is the most important issue in China-US relations.
US policy on the issue of Taiwan is unchanged as of today.
No, nothing's changed.
The US side must handle the Taiwan issue with the utmost prudence.
So we know where they stand, and I think they know where we stand.
I'm not looking to have somebody go independent and, you know, we're supposed to travel 9,500 miles to fight a war. I'm not looking for that. I want them to cool down. I want China to cool down.
How are your talks, sir?
It's great. Great place. Incredible. China's beautiful.
We did discuss Iran.
He said, I would love to be a help. If I can be of any help whatsoever, he'd like to see the Hormuz Strait open. But we don't need help. And you know the problem with help? When somebody helps you, they always want something on the other side.
first thing to say is dialogue is always better than no dialogue, and I think they may have a few more meetings even just in the rest of this year, which is a good thing. Did much come out of this much-hyped two-day summit, though? I mean, there's Iran, there's Taiwan, there's trade issues, there's all sorts of issues. It's a little unclear how much really came out in substance.
I think you'd believe Marco Rubio over Trump, and that what they did want was to get China to force Iran to open the Strait of Hormuz.
And that hasn't happened.
And it hasn't happened. And I think that the trade-off was going to be that they would allow China to take over Taiwan. And
it's
that
also,
didn't happen either.
No. Well, I'll come back to Taiwan. On trade, it's really interesting, Alan, because Trump, we know, is taking a very strong line in first term and in this term on China, big tariffs and even bigger tariffs in his second term, but then had to retreat after China, you know, pulled access to rare earths. His language around decoupling from China's gone, isn't it?
That's right. So they've had to realise, come to grips with the idea that they can't stop China. It can't be stopped. I mean, China is catching up to them and past them in so many different ways. So that what they need to do now is they've had to pivot their whole thinking about China from stopping it to containing it to
accepting it
and working with it.
And Taiwan, which is of course of great interest to Australia, watching nervously. He's basically maintaining that ambiguity, isn't he, about what the US might do should China make a move on Taiwan.
Well, that's as it appears from his public comments, although he did sort of tell Taiwan to stop the independence thing as well. Don't provoke. So, what do they call it? Strategic ambiguity, is the term. But, look, who knows? But I agree with Alan. I think the sort of what didn't come out of it is probably more interesting because China does have the leverage. When America and the Israelis bombed Iran last year, that one-off attack to degrade their nuclear capacity, Iran threatened to close the Strait of Hormuz then, and China said no. So China clearly could probably force it open now if they wanted to, and Trump's starting to get a bit desperate on that front.
Chinese ships are now getting through,
they
seem to be paying Iran's toll as well. So China's actually doing okay out of it. So they're not
in a great rush.
They're
and
okay.
Trump's, before he left, he said, it's becoming a problem in America now with the price of fuel. What was that sort of dismissive comment? He said his concern was Iran's nuclear capacity, not how much Americans are hurting. Well, that's not going to go down too well.
No.
Come the midterms. So.
Sam, one more issue for you. Our insiders, panellist and Saturday paper correspondent Jason Katsoukas has reported that Tony Abbott is not just seeking the Liberal Party presidency, which he is, but he's also shopping around for a seat back in Parliament. Shortland, Pat Conroy's Labor-held seat in New South Wales Hunter Valley was mentioned. What's going on?
Well, there's the official and the unofficial version.
I
consulted with the great man, Tony Abbott, and he said, no, I don't want to, I'm, not edging to come back into Parliament.
Okay.
Now there's the unofficial version. So the unofficial version is that Tony Abbott sees politics as a vocation, Jesuit raised, and Jesuit he will stay. He never wanted to leave. He would love to come back. If he did, it would not be in Melbourne. There was some speculation about Kooyong. Absolutely not true, not doing that. The idea about him eyeing off potentially a Central Coast seat is possible. Great surfing. And a nice kind of fit and vibe, some of that seat mentioned could be in the mix. But he's not doing it right now. But would he like to be back in politics and did he never want to leave? Yes, that's true.
Very interesting. All right.
But no plans just yet.
Not just yet. A couple of years before the election. Anyway, we'll see what happens with pre-selections.
Central Coast isn't going to know what hit them.
Let's get some final observations, Sam.
Well, there was a bit of petrol talk in the budget, but what they didn't say was whether or not they're going to extend the excise increase. No sign yet that they're necessarily going to do that, but that's obviously going to be a bit ugly for people when the price goes up, so it's worth thinking about. June 30, it could be all over.
Alan?
Well, one concrete thing that seems to have come out of the Trump-Xi summit was an order for 200 Boeing planes. And aircraft is one of the two industries that China has not achieved world domination, the other being computer chips.
Yep.
And they're working very hard on both of them.
Yeah, it's a good point. There's still the catch-up on a pretty important kit on both. Phil?
This week in the South Australian Parliament, the Premier will be introducing a bill to lift a moratorium on fracking in the state's southeast because to head off the impending gas shortage. The interesting thing about it, in the state's southeast, the two state holders, the MPs, one's a One Nation MP, one's a Liberal,
and they're opposed because of the potential for the impact on the water table down there. It's a big agricultural area. So well, you've got their leaders talking drill, baby, drill
or
in
gas.
Canberra.
Not so much. Yeah.
The resistance to this in South Australia may be coming from One Nation and the Liberal Party, so it
That's
does...
fascinating.
The,
there you go.
We'll see what happens, one thing to say. In the upper house, one or both.
Yeah, so. Very interesting. Thank you all very much at the end of this budget week. I really enjoyed that. Finally, budget week brought out some, well... interesting content on social media from our politicians. I've given up trying to work out what it all means, but we'll leave you with some of the quirkier offerings. Thanks for watching.
This year's Australian Albanese Labor government's budget is opening doors for Australian businesses.
Everybody going out of their skin, see if we get to the end, but
dirty, dirty, dirty George. I obviously didn't clean you before I left Canberra last time.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.